One exception, I think when I was a junior, because of course the whole European scene after World War II was a mess, with the Europe, much of Europe divided between three different, the French, the U.S., and the Soviet Union, which then included Eastern, many of the countries in Eastern Europe that are now ostensibly out from under the yoke of the Soviet Union. But we got two, I don't even think they were exchange students, I think they were two students from Eastern Europe somewhere, perhaps Poland, because of persecution of Catholics there, who came. Mundelein agreed to give them an education and arranged for them to live on campus. But that was pretty much it. Students were expected, especially on weekends, were expected to be somewhere else. And I suppose it was, in a way, it was the only time that the sisters had the place to themselves, because they all lived in the building. So you were kind of living, you were living with your work. And even though that was far more acceptable today than it would be to sisters today, who prefer not to have their workplace and their living in the same spot, at that time it was fairly acceptable. But the problem at Mundelein is, and any, I imagine any Roman Catholic college or private college, if you did have boarders during the week, and there were some, the weekend was about the only time when everybody could do their reading and research. I mean, if they were lucky enough to do that. Sometimes it was a matter in the early days, much before I got there, and the sisters were doing all the work. I mean, they cleaned the corridors, they cleaned the bathrooms, they cleaned everything. As it got on, certainly during my period, more of them were involved in study of one kind or another, research, and just plain keeping up with professional reading. And that would have afforded them time to do that.
Is there anyone in particular on the faculty or the staff during the time that you were a student that you remember that really stands out in your mind?
Yes, it would be Sister Mary Irma Corcoran. Mostly because we lived in 506, mm-hmm. and that was her place. That's where all the literary publications came to be. And of course, because I was an English major with a particular interest in writing, I had her as a junior and senior, probably for a total of four courses. And I'm not honestly sure that she was a good teacher. But she was an inspiring one. And I can remember having, in her classes now, having courses with her in which I'd have either my physics friend or my chemistry friend. And of course, they and their science buddies came into class. I think we were all required to have a one creative writing class, no matter who. You had to have one of them, no matter what your major. They would come in with their notebooks and their pencils poised. Irma would come in, usually a couple minutes late, had this enormous armload of books, which she would dump on the desk. And then she would start. And periodically she would pick up a book. They all had little pieces of paper tucked in, and she'd pick up a book and read. And then she, depending on, I mean, it was always related to whatever we were doing, this craft of the short story, poetry, playwriting, whatever. And she would be reading from those. For me, it was like I had died and gone to heaven. And I never expected to take a note. I also never knew I never had to worry about a grade. Because I don't, certainly for exams, I mean, whatever exams you had, I'm sure she never read them. Or at least we never got them back. She may have read them for her own used to know what wasn't coming across to people. But we never got it back. And we would get things back if she felt anything that was review material. We all agreed. We got things back. Joan Holland, Katie Quinn, myself. Those of us, you know, connected with review. We knew. You know. Now, I think the others must have gotten them back. But really, for most of them, they were putting in time. You know, and most of them, the grade was just fine. They all got, nobody got less than a B. And that was fine. But for me, for a particular kind of student interested in a particular area, it was wonderful. And she and I became good friends, remained friends for my entire life. She just died in the winter, February. We remained friends for her, for my whole lifetime, until she died. And right up to the end, she was no longer able to talk, and really was not conscious at all much. Even until the end, it was kind of a joke, and I think she knew it. They would say, well, if you have a lot of time, have lunch with Irma. I don't think there is a thing she ever experienced with her senses that she ever forgot. I don't think so. And I thought, I would listen to her, even at the age of 82 or 3, I'd think to myself, I don't remember as much as she has just reported to me in this conversation. It was amazing. And I just loved the way she went from one place to a place. And then she integrated, you know, reading from Thomas Mann or, you know, Brendan or Flaherty or whoever happened to illustrate me. So she had a plan. And you know, I actually have to say, Sandy, that when I came to teach creative writing at our high school in St. Paul after I was a BBM, it's really the best way to teach if you're ready for it and if you have any kind of inclination for it. If you can't teach people to write. But if you can expose them to what has been written, to the best of what has been written, and they can listen to the cadence of the writing, listen, look at the word choice, and see how precisely writers, skilled writers, can put those things together and the effect that they achieve. That's really their best education. But physics majors and chemistry majors and others were interested in making poetry some other way besides terms. And then at the end of class, you just bundle everything up again. And no matter when you saw her in the corridor, she had this bundle of books with the paper sticking out at every angle, some of which she got to in the course of the class and some of which she didn't. So when I say teacher, if you're talking about fact and that kind of thing, no. I don't think so. Not even in the course I had from her, where you actually could teach her fact. Or at least what we thought was back then. It wasn't very different.
She was a transgression.
Exactly. I think, I think it was partly, with her, it was partly because I was called to that particular area, and I was exposed to her style so much that she certainly would stand out. But I have to say, with few exceptions, the education I got, I'll tell you, I had a professor, Sister Mary Virginia, her last name. Of course, we didn't know it now or then. I learned it later. Who taught a Shakespeare course. I think it was the tragedies. She taught the tragedies and the comedies, and I took a semester of each. And I'm telling you, when I went to graduate school for my MA at Loyola in English, I wouldn't have had to study. I was every bit as prepared as and more so as my classmates in that master's program. With few exceptions, and of course many I didn't contact.
Mm-hmm.
With few exceptions, the teaching was excellent. Just excellent. And like that, sometimes we had people Therese, Sister Mary Therese, first woman astrophysicist. She was always out at Mount Palomar in California, conferring with that or the other. My friend Peggy Nolan, who was the physics major, loved her classes. She couldn't teach as well as her. And I said, Peggy, there you are. Now see, that's because, you know, stars and the planets and universe and all kind of that's your thing. Well, she kind of agreed. Yes, that is true. But she had the information, she just couldn't communicate. But in the main, we had wonderfully educated people. And they must have been wonderfully talented because, like people like Grandma, when they decided to build the college, when the sisters decided to build the college, it was at the height of the Depression. They got no help. They got an organ, I guess, from Cardinal Mundelein. Otherwise, they got no financial help, except from our own sisters in places like St. Mary's High School on the west side, and the Yamada, up here, I'm sure, on the drive. And from other places throughout the community where we had parish schools and caries. They had no one ready with PhDs. So these folks, like Irma, were appointed to the college and sent immediately to study. Sister Mary Joseph Therese, in science, I think she was a chemist, biologist. She couldn't even, at the time, she couldn't even be in a lab with the men. She was the only woman there, a nun, and she couldn't sit in the labs with the men. She had to go after hours. And she would listen to the lectures sitting on a folding chair outside the door. Now imagine, I mean, so many of them had that experience. It's just mind-boggling to me, the natural talent, the natural intellect that those women had. Coming from all walks of life, professional families and not, who were assembled on that first faculty, and for whom a person like myself can say, and I don't think it's out of any loyalty to the BBM community, because there were difficulties as well. I mean, there were some that didn't teach and were interested in proselytizing. But in the main, that was not my experience. In the main, you applied yourself. You've got an education that was comparable to any and better to most.
One of the things that, in reviewing your background, in the Mundelein Review, you were not only involved as an editor, and in many capacities you were a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two poems that I found that you had written. And I typed them out. One is Perspective, and the other is Abdication. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to read one of them or both of them for me and tell me what you remember about...
Well, first of all, I don't remember what I remember.
Okay.
And secondly, I figure whatever it means is for you to take away your own meaning. I'll read Abdication since it's the most frivolous, and if I make a mistake, it won't sound as quite as bad. We had a cat once. Not the garbage kind, but one who strawed warm milk like a lady, wooing and being wooed by stove-legged soldiers. She gave up her wicker and pillow, her warm-blooded lieutenants, for a call from the alley. The queen is dead. She died without telling us. We actually never had a cat.
Oh, you didn't?
Okay. My recollection of that is that that one of my friends, and I can't even tell you, Gladys O'Brien, I can't remember who, was very broken up because, or maybe this was when she was younger, and she recalled being very broken up as a child because this cat, who came to them as a kitten, and whom she looked upon as her companion in crime, just one day disappeared. And that they blamed, there was a tomcat in the back alley, I guess, and they blamed that cat in the back alley. But the cat was, for a lot of the time, confined to the kitchen when there was company in the house, and actually preferred the kitchen, especially during meal preparation or shortly thereafter, because it was warm. And she had her little, you know, pillow that she cuddled on. And I think that was really actually the stimulus. And it was probably written for a class in poetry, because it wasn't an experience that I ever had. We had dogs who also liked the stove, but unlike the cat, they didn't desert their post. But they were probably not as mobile, not as free as I had the idea this particular cat was. She was going in and out all the time. She went out one day, and her heart took over. That was the end of it.
Obviously, you love writing, and you loved your friends in college. What do you think you took from your undergraduate experience? What is the most important thing that you took from that experience?
You know, that's really hard to say. I mean, I look upon my colleges, as I think many college graduates do, as probably certainly the last time of innocence, if you can call it that, or the last time where, you know, in my year anyway, you really had no responsibilities. I couldn't even work, or consider this, I couldn't even work in college. My parents took the position that my dad worked in this office. My mother took care of the home and the family. My job was to go to school. And if I had any extra time, I would be using it to read, to study, whatever. And I guess I just kind of accepted that as my thing, but I remember coming home once, and it was after a psychology class in which the teacher directed us to our library and said, I want you to read X essay. It's in the books, in the stacks. There's only one book, so you're going to have to, you know, kind of share. And I remember with a class of 22 or 3 people, I never did get that book. And I thought to myself, at that time, the Mundelein Library was in what is now Piper Hall. The stacks were upstairs on the second and third floor. So you went to the desk with your little call slip, and the student librarian, usually a student, would go up the stairs or go up in the elevator and bring your book down. Only employees could go into the stacks. So I thought to myself, that would be a good job. It's a win-win situation. Because the minute I got an assignment on a book or a magazine that could not leave the library, I could race over there, run up to the stacks, because I was an employee. That is really the only reason I was able to get a job. My father and mother thought, yeah, that's a nice place to have a job, in a library. Good surroundings. So I did. And now I forget why I got off. I'm a real high intuitive, so you'll have to understand I go from subject to subject with very little. Sometimes I'm surprised at where I end. And you asked about what I took away. I guess it would have to be, although I didn't recognize it at the time, a real sense of myself. Not so much as a woman, but as a human being with a lot of potential who can make a contribution. I guess that's what it would be. Because we weren't even woman conscious. I mean, honestly, we had Loyola next door, so if we ever wanted a man, it was real simple. And when we, you know, if we had mixers and such, we always had plenty of people coming from South Bend, coming from Rensselaer, coming from Catholic colleges and universities around that would come by the busload just for a dance on Friday night or Saturday night. And so I guess we never suffered. Some people look at women's colleges and say, oh, gee, deprived of men. We weren't deprived of men. We were real happy to have our space, honestly. I mean, even those who were really on the lookout for a man and were, as the joke says, looking for an MRS instead of a BA or a BS. And some did. Some and dropped out of college and made very happy marriages and happy homes. So I think we weren't women conscious, but we knew somehow that there was a lot you didn't have to explain, as you would have to do, as we did when we were in clubs that were mixed, where you had to sort of provide a rationale, which seemed kind of fundamental, but then the men seemed to need it, and those are the questions that we're asking, well, you know, where'd this come from? And so we all came with things we can assume about one another. Not all the assumptions, of course, were accurate, and that made for conflicts occasionally. But basically, as women, we could all kind of assume the same things, and there was no problem of standing up in class and saying, you know, I really don't think that would work, or I don't think that's a good policy, we never had any conscious sense of being women as opposed to men. We never had any sense of the other. There was nothing like that. But we were proximate to an area where if men were needed for one thing or another, there were always men that were there. You know. Now, in another place, probably a more remote place, either a men's Catholic university, private university, or a women's, that could be problematic. Although today I wouldn't doubt that kids could get on a commuter plane if they wanted badly enough and go where they wanted to go. But I think it is. I think it's just a sense of you are a human being with something to offer, and with the sense that you've been given a lot. Because as we went out, all of us, there weren't a lot of people, even in my grade school class, out there and now very affluent Sauganish and Edgebrook and Lincolnwood. Even out there, many of my classmates didn't go to college because they were children of Nouveau Riche. They happened to own a factory or some small business, or maybe it turned a fishing cottage into a little motel resort facility made a little business out of it. Many of them were like that, and they didn't, college was not, they were successful without having to go to college. So there were a lot of people we ran into, even from affluent places after the war, that had become affluent as a result of the war. And we're not particularly interested in or feeling the need for a college education. So, in a sense, I think we were not feeling blessed that we had the education we had, that our parents made the sacrifices necessary to make sure that we did. So I think that would be what, probably. Now, if you got me after graduation at the age of 21 and said, now, what did you get out of this? I'd say, I'd probably cry a lot. I don't know what I'd say, but at this distance, certainly, and certainly finishing graduate school, it was very clear to me that my education there was just superior. small college.
Did you think of yourself during that time as an undergrad as being progressive?
I didn't. And I don't think, again, I think I probably could speak to my friends if they regarded themselves as progressive. They might now look back and say, yes, we were progressive. And there were certain things in Mundelein's history at the time I was there that people looking back would say, oh, that's pretty progressive for a small Roman Catholic liberal arts college. Because the Catholic Student Association started to get up and running at the time. And that took over a lot of our thinking, and not just among those people who were trying to get a charter and trying to plug into it, but for all of us. We all had to be, we were educated in, and what it would mean to become a member, a charter member of the student Congress, what our rights were, what our obligations were, responsibilities. So I think looking back, that was groundbreaking. And it certainly then provided the groundwork for a lot of other organizations that developed from that. But no, I certainly can't say I wasn't conscious of it. I think we were doing things and having our consciousness raised before a lot of other places. But then my dad would come home when I was in grade school and talk about some elderly lady that was, you know, the landlord put her furniture out on the sidewalk, and a nephew or somebody, niece came. They had no money to help. What could be? And he was in this legal aid, had volunteered in this legal aid place. And worked on her behalf. So we heard a lot of those things, and I didn't think of that as social justice or, you know, helping the poor and disenfranchised or any of that. I just thought that's what he did. That's what you do for a living. So I guess it never was a conscious thing to me that, yet there were many, many innovations, and even in the realm of entertainment, Mundelein was the first in the city. Now, consider, University of Chicago, Loyola University, the bunch, the first in the city to have a projection booth in the auditorium where you could show 35-millimeter films. So, you know, the faculty member or members and friends in the theater. But they're not a theater. I don't know if it was a woman or manager at the time, of course, which was a very popular place. And the nuns couldn't go out. So he would show these, he would bicycle 20-minute canisters down. That was before movies became digitalized and you don't have it that way. But you know, the projectionist would finish one, put the next reel up, and they'd be bicycled down to Mundelein, and the nuns would be sitting there watching all these, any movie they wanted, really. Mm-hmm. And of course, students were around, they were welcome to see it as well. So there were lots of innovations from both from the point of view of the technological, little recreational things like that, too. I think the Student Association, the involvement in the civil rights movement, which was right at the beginning, at the cutting edge, with other forward-looking places. That came later, of course, but I was teaching here at the time, and my students and my sisters were getting in the buses. And, you know, we had one person on the faculty who was an attorney, actually. She, Catherine Brophy, who was Sister Mary Liguori. She was in my dad's law class. My dad and my aunt and Liguori and probably 20 others graduated from DePaul Law School together. And mean, she was teaching her classes. She wasn't a real good teacher either. She knew a lot. She wasn't a real good teacher. She should have practiced law, but nuns didn't practice law at the time. And that was sad. But anyway, my father said she was probably had the best legal mind in his class, which is saying something, because my father has always been told. I mean, that's what we've been told, that my dad had a fine legal mind. So if he was saying that about her, she was pretty good. And she would, on her off time, be working in legal clinics or be accompanying somebody to a court, an elderly person or disabled person, or somebody that needed somebody to speak to. There's lots of them before that became kind of a regular occurrence. And before people were using it for books, mm-hmm. writing their books.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's a long, very long-winded response. I hope you can find something that's a nugget. A gold nugget.
Is there anything else about your experience as an undergraduate student here that you would want me to know?
Well, you know, Cindy, I can't think of anything. I must say you're a good questioner. You have good questions. I mean, you interview very naturally. So you make people comfortable. You know, it's not like you're kind of